You are listening to the ForceCom Frontline, bringing you to our soldiers on the front lines of readiness. Hey everyone, welcome to the ForceCom Frontline. I'm Ashley and I'm your host. Today we are joined by soldiers from the 20th Seaburning Command, and that's chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosives. And I'm not going to say that again. We are talking about an exercise that they just finished up called Prominent Hunt, which is part of a series of regularly scheduled biannual exercises by the U.S. government, which have been conducted since 2012. This is a joint exercise that also included the FBI and the Department of Energy. During the exercise, the command's Ground Collection Task Force was evaluated for its capability to efficiently mobilize, deploy, plan, collect material and debris samples, while also processing and preparing samples for transport to designated analytical laboratories in a post-detonation environment. Oh my goodness, that was a lot of words. So joining me to make us all a little bit smarter on this are Major Jonathan Schwartz, and he is the 20th Seaburning Command G3 Nuclear Exercise Planner, and Major Aaron Heffelfinger, and he is the command's Nuclear Disablement Team Deputy Team Chief. So thank you both for being here.
Nailed it. Thank you.
That was a lot. I feel like I'm sweating a little bit. Whoa. So, you know, I just gave a brief overview of the exercise, but it was a lot. And I said a lot of words that I'm not sure I even understood. So in layman's terms, and Major Schwartz, I think this one's for you, as the planner, can you explain what Prominent Hunt is and its goal?
Sure. The mission of the U.S. government for Prominent Hunt is that we stand ready to execute this mission, but hope we never have to. Following a nuclear detonation in either the homeland or abroad with one of our allies and partners, the U.S. government sustains this capability to rapidly collect what we call nuclear debris. And that supports attribution of whoever perpetrated this attack. The National Technical Nuclear Forensics Ground Collection Task Force, and I know that's a mouthful, but that's who we are. It's comprised of the DOD, FBI, and Department of Energy. And then, like you said at the top, this Prominent Hunt exercise, it's a biannual training event where the interagency comes together to validate this important capability.
Okay. And so the goal is really for these agencies to come together and make sure that, you know, if this was to happen real world, that we all know how to work together.
Not only that we know how to work together, that we know how to collect those nuclear debris samples, okay, and then attribute it back to the state or non-state actor, whoever caused that nuclear detonation on either CONUS or OCONUS-friendly partner ally soil.
Okay. And so, Aaron, Major Heffelfinger, so everybody knows I'm going with Aaron from now on. So from the 20th Seaburning side, a nuclear disablement team participated in the exercise, and this is not something that I had ever heard of before. I told you before, my husband was EOD, and so that was like my short little experience in the 20th Seaburning land. So can you talk about what a nuclear disablement team is and their role in the exercise?
Yeah, sure. So the nuclear disablement teams, 20th Seaburn has three nuclear disablement teams. Each one consists of 11 personnel. So the mixture that you have there are Army FA-52 nuclear and counter WMD officers. You have health physics personnel as well as Seaburn specialists. So our mission on the NDT is to characterize and disable nuclear infrastructure. So that can be anything ranging from uranium mines and mills all the way up to plutonium reprocessing facilities. So we would go into a facility like that, determine what it is, what they're doing there, the throughput, and then report that back through our higher headquarters so that we can take action as necessary. Now, as it pertains to the Ground Collection Task Force, that is an additional mission that we take on, but we are very well suited for it due to our nuclear expertise.
So a couple of things. I feel like I should have taken a chemistry class before I talked to you all, because I did not pass chemistry. But you mentioned health physics, I believe. What is health physics?
So our health physics specialists, ma'am, their mission is to basically make sure that what we're doing is safe from a radiological perspective. So they are the experts that are making sure that we're going into a facility with proper PPE, as well as ensuring that our dose that we're receiving from a radiological source stays within the established guidelines by both the DOD and as well as OSHA and some of the facilities that we're in.
Okay. This is a lot. You know,
shout out to the 72 Alpha Career Fields of the United States Army. They make up from AMED, they make up the health physicists, and there's only about 100 of them in the Army. And we're fortunate enough to have three down on the nuclear disablement teams and then another one up here at the headquarters.
Yeah. So it really is like a holistic effort when you're looking at these problem situations or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, for sure.
So going back to the exercise, Major Schwartz, can you talk about the roles of the organizations involved and how they all come together? Because like I said, this was not just Army.
Sure. I mean, we can start with the DOD. And we just explained kind of the NDT's role, even though the NDTs are structured, trained, manned, and equipped for nuclear infrastructure. So before a weapon detonates in the buildup to getting to a nuclear device, even though that's their role, of the Seaburn world, they make up the R and the N. These 33 soldiers here at the 20th Seaburnee Command are the RAD and the nuke specialists. So even though they have another job that the Army asks them to do, they are the most equipped for this one mission. So for DOD, one NDT, so that's 11 soldiers, they make up one portion of it. Also, in addition to that one NDT, the Army also brings another force comm element. That's the Seaburn response team, known as the CRT. CRT is a platoon of chem soldiers from a technical escort chem company who are the Army's premier force for Seaburn exploitation and assessment. And these soldiers are sampling experts. They lead the ground collection team and each of their nuclear debris collection missions when they're going out actually taking the sampling. Under DOD, there's also the Air Force. And the Air Force is represented on the task force by one technical event field lead. And this is an airman scientist, a super small career field. The AFSC is 61 Delta, a physicist and nuclear engineer. And this airman comes to us from the Air Force Technical Application Center based out of Florida's Patrick Space Force Base. And then in coordination with the National Labs and the Department of Energy, that TEFL uses science and modeling to determine which samples from the nuclear fallout need to be collected next. And that rounds out the DOD's portion.
Okay.
For the Department of Energy, they provide support before, during, and after each collection. So before the mission launches, the DOE technical team lead works with that Air Force TEFL to review the nuclear fallout models and determine the recommended sample areas to be collected. And then during the collection, Energy provides a collection support scientist to go out with those two CRT members. That person goes out into the field and they're actually doing the RAD readings in order to help inform our two CRT members to make the best collection possible. And then finally, after the sample is collected, the Department of Energy runs a field expedient sample processing lab. Their team of scientists cleans and prepares each sample for a preliminary analysis of its isotopic content and radioactivity. And the results of their field presumptive analysis help inform back to our plan section if that was a successful collection or if a different sample is going to end up being needed on that collection. And then the last piece of it is the FBI. So the FBI, a senior special agent from the FBI, they end up serving as the task force lead. The FBI Laboratory Division and the local FBI field office provide support to the task force, and they provide that incident command structure for the task force, along with any kind of local law enforcement coordination with the federal, state, and locals. And then additionally, they're also responsible for keeping that chain of custody when the sample is collected out in the field with the Department of Energy and our two CRTs until it all the way comes back to our FOB, where it's going through their sample processing, the DOE sample processing line, and then ends up getting on fixed or rotary wing, flying out to a U.S. national lab in order to be actually analyzed. In an Oconee, I guess I should mention too, that there's also another player who wasn't part of this because in an Oconee environment, the Department of State would be involved and they would liaise with the host nation to facilitate any kind of task force movement through the country, but only in Oconee environment. So this exercise that we just did down in Houston, Texas, it was just DOD, Department of Energy, and FBI.
Okay. And so when I first saw FBI, I thought, oh, that's interesting. But the more you explain it, it kind of totally makes sense, especially when you're talking about chain of custody and all of that.
When we start talking about command authorities and who is responsible, it really comes down to the FBI is the lead for this mission. And then the United States Army, we bring the soldier scientists and we bring those samplers from the CRT in order to really make this an effective task force.
Sure. So this might be a silly question, but just amuse me. So when we're talking about getting ground samples, are you like if you can't talk about it, then just tell me we can't talk about it. But are you actually replicating something that so when your soldiers go out and they are testing the ground, they are getting samples from the ground that they're actually finding something?
Yeah, so because in real life, they would be collecting actually radiologically hot samples. There's a obvious hesitation to go out there with radiological sure. samples and place them around. That would not be good for our soldiers or the local populace. Sure. So they will go out with debris that is very visually similar to what we would see in an actual nuclear event.
Okay.
And then the observer controllers from the Department of Energy will feed them that information that we would be getting. So as long as they're using the detectors properly out there, they will give them what the dose rate, how hot that sample is, so that we can actually process it as if it was a real sample.
Okay.
But all the procedures that they would follow in real life, from wearing the proper PPE, which, you know, in Houston, wearing two layers of Tyvek taped up at every seam is very sweaty.
Yeah.
So from the correct PPE, they're using the same tools to collect. We have a modified Dyson vacuum cleaner with a special collection jar underneath. So they're using the exact tools that they would use to do this. And they're going through the exact same procedures when they bring that sample back. So,
you know,
when the sample, sample comes back and the DOE takes control of it, they are actually still processing it as if it had that radiological signature.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the modified Dyson. I saw a picture of that, and I wasn't sure if it was real or not, but it is?
That is real.
That is our real tool, man. We have an entire container filled with contingency Dyson vacuum cleaners.
You know, I really need a Dyson.
And if you picture really the nuclear debris that our soldiers are going out to go collect, some pieces of it are like the dirt and dust that you'd find in your house. It really is.
Wow.
Hard to believe that something so common as a Dyson vacuum is our sample collection tool, but it ends up being just perfect for the size of debris and the size of sample. Picture, you know, pieces of dirt that are coming off of your shoes after you've been out playing in the mud.
Sure.
You come back inside on your doormat. Some of that is the size debris that our soldiers are going out there collecting, and a Dyson is just perfect for it.
And so are they going to different sites then? Because I would assume if this was a real-world scenario, your detonation, I'm not using any of the right words, but it would not be concentrated to one area.
Yeah, ma'am. So the Air Force scientists, as well as the DOE scientists, are going to give us where they need those samples taken based off of different aspects they would expect to see within those samples when they come back. So
Okay. Typically
we will sample close to ground zero. We will sample farther away. And then we'll also take samples of the very fine particles that are way at the end of the fallout plume, because there's different signatures embedded within all those types of particles.
Okay. And so I have derailed from my questions here, but I'm going to keep going. What are you looking for?
So what we're looking for, ma'am, is the particles that are either sucked up within the soil when it goes up into the mushroom cloud and then is taken downwind and deposited, or actual material that's left over. So when a weapon goes off, it's not like all of it actually goes off. There are pieces of that material, of that special nuclear material fuel, that don't fission and don't do anything except vaporize and then re-solidify, and then those are deposited as well. So they're looking for those traces within that as well.
Okay.
And that's how we can really attribute where that came from.
And I feel like I read something that like the wind is taken into account because things blow.
Yep. So as those particles are sucked up from that vacuum that's created when the nuclear weapon detonates and it comes back in and sucks everything up, the wind that is at altitude or at very high altitude is what's going to carry those particles. So the much larger, heavier particles are going to settle much closer to ground zero.
Sure.
And then that real fine, think of it like powdered sugar particulate, is going to get pushed much, much further downwind. Okay. So that's why we take that huge range within that fallout area.
Okay. And again, I'm just trying to get smart here. So would you be looking for radioactive material that could potentially impact civilians? Is that what?
It's an interesting thought, because if this, God forbid, this were ever to happen, consequence management has nothing to do with this group that goes out as part of the Ground Collection Task Force. So there would be a very large, robust package from the U.S. government made up of many different agencies. Sure. That would go out in a consequence management capacity and would be very worried about all of the civilians and all of the locals in that host nation. Okay. However, this task force, our primary focus is going out and getting those samples that Aaron was talking about.
Okay.
You know, if you think back to the science class you said you struggled at, you probably learned about radioactive material and half-life. A lot of these isotopic elements that we're going out to collect are constantly decaying, and we have to go out and get them pretty quickly in order to get them to the lab, in order to analyze them before they're just gone in some cases, or else we won't have that evidence, we won't have that data. So it would be very difficult for our team to do consequence management in addition to this mission. So that's why we divorce the two. There is a separate, there are elements within ForceCom that do this consequence management, but we specifically only focus on the nuclear forensics, and we are going out there as quick as we can on a prepare to deploy order in order to get those samples and get them out to a lab so they can be analyzed for attribution.
And so how quickly would you say that you have to get them to the lab?
The faster the better, man. Okay. So we once the NDT assumes this mission, because we rotate it between the three teams, it's kind of understood that if you are taking leave, there is somebody that can replace you at a minute's notice. So there's a lot of leave management that goes into this, a lot of pre-preparations. Our containers stay packed with everything minus stuff that we can't afford to lose in the motor pool, like radios and other sensitive items. But everything else is pre-prepared to go. Our paperwork to get stuff on an aircraft is prepared and ready to go. All we have to do is put in what airport we're leaving from, so we can very rapidly leave APG and get to where we have to go.
Okay. All right.
Just on a side note, and you can cut it if you want, but the the pieces that get classified are the times, the number of samples, how fast we can do it. So we try and message like a deterrent statement where we're going to go as fast as we can.
No, absolutely. That makes complete sense.
Okay. Just so you know.
No, thank you for giving the right answer. So Major Schwartz, back to you, being the planner, how much preparation goes into an interagency exercise like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's about, if we look at the NDTs and look at the actual players that are going through the exercise, it's about 1 month train up for each team member to stand on the PTDO and perform this mission. But it's not just 1 month, 4 weeks straight. We start the train up with an academics block of instruction, where we invite all those other agencies that I mentioned to come here to Aberdeen Proving Grounds and to train our soldiers on what their organization, their home interagency organization does in order to support the task force. So that's step one. Then we have the soldiers who are currently on the PTDO provide blocks of instruction and collection techniques and help those soldiers that are coming onto the PTDO kind of understand the nuclear fallout models. And then that's, I guess, if you put it in Army terms, that would be individual training, would be the first step of it. And that lasts about a week, week and a half. So after gaining a basic understanding of kind of how the task force works, then these soldiers travel out to the Nevada National Security Site. And that's where, if you think back to history, that's where the U.S. government performed all of its above ground nuclear testing back in the 1950s and 60s. And there's actual nuclear debris out there at the site. And then these soldiers, they'll go out there and they'll work with the Department of Energy geologists in order to understand the various characteristics of nuclear debris. So then they know what they're actually looking for if this were to actually happen. So now that you have an individual training where soldiers understand their individual tasks and they understand how the task force operates, then they're trying to come together with their collective tasks. And for that, that's where the NDT works with that CRT to develop TTPs, smart cards, briefing products, and just iron out their efficiencies to be a cohesive team. And that takes about another week. So now we're up to 2-3 weeks of training at that point. And then finally, we put it all together. We put the incoming NDT and the CRT through a large-scale interagency task force validation exercise, Prominent Hunt. And then each agency sends their teams who are going to be serving on the PTDO in order to validate so that they can accept the mission. And then it's important to build those relationships. Like any interagency, the first time you meet these people should not be when the event happens. Yep. So it's important to build those relationships. That's also why we do the Prominent Hunt exercise. And it's important for even the observer controllers, evaluators to go in order to help see those same faces. The WMD community, while it may seem large, you see a lot of the same faces over and over again. And it's really good to keep building those relationships and to have the interagency together so that you recognize who your counterparts would be if this mission ever happened, which obviously we hope not.
Right. And I was going to ask you later on, but I guess I'll ask you now. Other than this exercise, when are you getting together with these other organizations to build those relationships?
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny when I ran into a couple people at the exercise, I realized that, you know, these are the same people that work on other contracts and other training that support us. It's like Aaron was saying how the NDTs, we focus on nuclear infrastructure. The WMD world, like I said, is kind of small. So as it turns out, every member of this task force has another primary job. So supporting this mission is just an additional duty. The NDTs focus on nuclear infrastructure for foreign nations, but this is an additional duty and something that they stand ready to do because they make up that R and N of CBRNE. So we see many of the same faces when we train for that primary nuclear infrastructure mission. They come out and they support in a different capacity, either as a laboratory scientist or another observer controller or another exercise planner. Okay. We see a lot of the same faces for all of our WMD work.
Okay. So we were talking about soldiers. So Aaron, you know, what is the value of a training like this for the soldiers on your team?
So I would say that every soldier on our team, even though this is not our primary mission, gets something very valuable out of it. So the Army officer FA-52s, we get to talk and work with the DOE and AFTAC experts that are also nuclear scientists, because a lot of us have nuclear degrees, nuclear engineering, nuclear physics, nuclear policy. So this is a chance for us to really learn, but even sometimes teach them some new things as well. So yeah, we get a lot out of it. We get to actually exercise our background expertise in this. Our health physics personnel, there's not often that they're actually doing contamination control and worrying about whether people are dragging radioactive materials out of an area.
Sure.
So that team gets to push out and establish their forward contamination control line, the FICL. And actually, when these soldiers come back out of this modeled plume, get to ensure that nothing is brought back to the FOB with them. So okay, our CBRN specialists, in addition to helping out at that FICL, they also partake in collections if needed. And importantly for them as well, being a 74 Delta, there's really no other 74 Deltas within the NDTs minus the E5 and the junior enlisted soldier that we have. So when we work with these CRTs, you're talking senior 74 Deltas up to the rank of E7. So they do get a lot of mentorship as well.
Sure.
And the nice part is that it really inspires them to want to work for the CRTs as well, because they see what the CRTs are doing. And a lot of our soldiers are very motivated to someday also serve on a CRT. So the other part of it is a huge benefit is even as a major, my opportunities to interact with the Department of Justice and the Department of Energy, minus the training that John talked about that we do with the Department of Energy, it's not often that you're just interacting with personnel like that. So to have a major or a private talking to a SSA from the FBI, that's a pretty big step forward.
Absolutely.
So being able to talk and work comfortably with our interagency partners is a great training opportunity.
Well, yeah, I mean, if I can add one more thing too.
Yeah.
So like when I thought about your question here as well, as Aaron was answering, like the first term soldiers never have opportunities like this ever. A first term, you know, private, lieutenant, regardless, you know, so they have access to more PhDs. I mean, argue if you want, but like I think you can't throw a pencil and hit like six different PhDs when we're in these exercises. They have unfettered access in between the training exercise and when things aren't moving fast, where they can just ask every rad new question on their mind and get so sharp in their skill set that I'm envious that as a lieutenant, like I didn't have those kind of opportunities looking back at it.
Yeah. Our last prominent hunt, the one in Bethany Beach in January, I happened to turn around during some downtime and my private was receiving classes on nuclear physics from the AFTAC PhD. So
bingo.
I don't know where else you would see that.
Yeah. That's amazing. And I mean, you know, we're obviously talking about this exercise, but the more you guys talk about what you're doing in, you know, just 20th Seaburney as a whole, it's incredible what y'all do and what y'all bring to the fight. So tell your PAO we're recruiting too.
There we go. We will let Steve know.
So, Aaron, I'm going to go back to you again. And I know there's only a few things. I mean, you can't talk about everything, I'm sure. But were there any things in the exercise, any scenarios that popped up that were unexpected?
So typically the training exercise that we do to assume the mission is when all the contingencies are worked out. So they will purposely inject vehicle breakdowns, soldiers receiving too high of a dose, to see how the team will react to something like that. And if you can quickly and efficiently plan through and work through those issues. So when we go into these big exercises, we're now there's always things that we're not prepared for. But for instance, we had a soldier who accidentally wiped his face to try and get some sweat off, but he was in a contaminated area. So they said, hey, we hate to break it to you, but you just received a dose from that contamination that it exceeded your guidelines that were set forward. So the benefit of what we do with the amount of training we do to assume this mission is we establish a list of CCIRs, Commander's Critical Information Requirements. So those are all the things that when it's DOD specific, whoever is in command, or in this case, the FBI SSA, if these incidents happen, they must know so that they can make a decision. So knowing that, and from what we experienced at the last prominent hunt, we came up with a list of contingencies for all of these CCIRs. Okay. So that happened to be one of them. And we had, I think, four different courses of action pre-prepared. And she just had to pick at the moment which one made the most sense for the scenario. And I think within 5 minutes, we had worked through the situation, continued on with the collection, and brought it back successfully.
I mean, Aaron, can we sidebar real quick?
Yeah.
So, you know that wasn't planned, right?
Oh, I know.
That, okay, yeah. So, yeah, so I mean, this was real. This was a real, what he is talking about right now for like an unexpected scenario, that is real. And as an exercise planner, we didn't plan that. And this crew knocked it out of the park. Like it was something as an exercise planner, having a soldier go into a rad field and we give them limits to make sure that they don't receive too much exposure and they hit the limit that was set. I mean, we don't set the limit as planners, but your team did that. Their team established CCIR. That's not something as an exercise planner I can make them do. And they did it. And everything went perfect. And as a exercise planner, like I look at this and I think to myself, like, this is the team that's ready to accept this mission. We did not plan that scenario, but they came across something that had a serious safety issue for a soldier. And through the task force lead with Aaron as the deputy task force leader, and with the Department of Energy deputy, the three of them sat down and made the choice that they were going to accept more risk and continue that mission, continue pushing those soldiers forward into the rad fields, into the plume. And in the end, like it was absolutely fine, the amount of radiation that they would have received this, if this were real. No one made any kind of hasty decisions. Everything still was in the best interest of both the mission and our soldiers to keep them safe. But it was a level of risk. They sat down as an interagency together, and I could not have planned it any better as an exercise planner. It's just something that happened.
Well, and it's such a small thing too, and especially being in Texas, it's hot. So it's very normal for you to want to wipe the sweat off your face. So, I mean, it's interesting. It's awesome that they did the right thing and they were able to work through it. But
I know it's hard to picture these soldiers. So literally think of the N95 mask that people wore through the pandemic.
Okay.
And having to wear that in Houston heat with sweat. And you're working and climbing around a truck and getting in and out of the truck, and the AC is maybe not the best, and you're up Armin 1151.
And imagine two layers of basically a white trash bag taped around you, locking all that sweat and perspiration in.
So I'm now you're sweating and you want to touch your face to fix that mask.
So I'm thinking E.T., like the people in E.T.
There you are. All right. We are on the same page.
Okay, perfect. So listeners, ET. So we are going to run out of time very quickly. But you talked about how your soldiers did. But I have a random question for both of you. What is your background in? I mean, we're talking about nuclear disablement. Like, how did you end up here?
Well, so my background, I majored in math, which I never thought I would use it for anything. It was just something that I thought was easy for me. I commissioned as an air defense officer, and I did Avenger Stinger and Patriot, and I got an email from our branch proponent saying, would you like to become an Army nuclear officer? So I thought, you know, it'd be nice for a change. So ended up doing that, went off to the Air Force Institute of Technology and got my master's degree in nuclear engineering. Wow. And ended up here actually working with John when he was the deputy for NDT-1.
So I feel like science plays a big role in that too. Was science like a thing for you?
Science is definitely a thing for us. Yeah.
Were you good at it?
Few people that science every day.
Yeah. So our career field, we make up the Functional Area 52 Nuclear and Counter Weapons of Mass Destruction officers. My background was in biochemistry with a bachelor's, and then my master's, I studied scientific and technical intelligence with a concentration in weapons of mass destruction and looking at proliferation in foreign countries. But what we look for, this is a plug for our career field, for those interested, those officers who are looking for a VTIP that are captains, what we look for are folks with strong STEM backgrounds. And if you don't have a strong STEM background, a desire to have a strong STEM background, because we will send you to grad school and we'll help get you there. But you have to have the requisite baseline knowledge and drive and be a competitive officer. But we make up that career field, the Functional Area 52s. We are two of, about 300 or so.
Well, y'all are very smart. So thank you for helping me be a little bit smarter. I just do words and talk to people. So I'm amazed at what you guys can do. It's truly phenomenal.
Thanks.
But I appreciate, we're going to very quickly run out of time. I appreciate you guys taking the time to help me be smarter about this, as well as our listeners. I truly appreciate your time.
Cool. Thanks so much. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. That's it for this episode. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and you can also find full video episodes of our podcast on YouTube. You can just search for the Force Comm Frontline, and we'll see you next time on the Frontline.